Blog Talk Radio.
How long have I been living my mind? How long have I been living my mind?
Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth in Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome, everyone. Happy Mother's Day to all you moms out there. With me today is not a mother, but he is a father, so I guess that means on Father's Day I need to have a mom on the show. But anyway, with me today is author Aris Janigian. How are you, Aris?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing great.
I gave my
kiss this morning, and I'm taking it to the beach after this interview.
Nice, nice. Well, I'm very excited to have you on the show today. Aris Janigian holds a Ph.D. in psychology, and from 1993 to 2005, he was senior professor of humanities at Southern California Institute of Architecture. He's published in genres as diverse as poetry, social psychology, and design criticism. He was a contributing writer to West. I loved West, by the way, the L.A. Sunday Times Magazine, and was a finalist for the William Saroyan Fiction Prize. Aris is the author of two previous novels, Bloodvine and River Big, and his most current novel is entitled This Angelic Land. Aris, let's begin by having you tell the listeners a little about This Angelic Land.
This Angelic Land is a book that occurs over, most of it occurs during the 3-4 days of the 1992 Los Angeles riots. We celebrated is maybe not the right word, but we recognized the 20th anniversary of it last year, and we just passed the 21st anniversary. The protagonist is a refugee of the Lebanese Civil War. He's 10 years old when his family flees Lebanon for America. He's now 27 when the riots break out. Bar owner in the Mid-Wilshire area, graduate from USC, business major. And it's about his 4-day journey through, the hells of the 1992 riots.
You take the title of the novel from the Blake poem, America, a Prophecy. Can you talk a little about the connection and significance of the pairing when played out in your novel?
Sure. When I was searching for a title, I did a lot of reading and just looking for little phrases. And I was reading through Blake, and I came across this poem, America, a Prophecy. And Blake was a mystic poet and kind of a seer, really. And in this poem, he is watching, from England, from the other side of the Atlantic, America come to birth. And he sees it as obviously a violent revolution. But out of that storm of a rebellion rises something that he feels had not been seen by man before, where he prophesies that it will be so. And so as I was, it's a very hopeful, I think, prophecy, but at the same time comes of great pain and a fire. So as I was writing the novel, I really felt like this was a way to frame the book, that we are undergoing now another kind of fire of cleansing, or perhaps not, and that something will rise out of it. I'm not going to say, I'm not even sure the novel says what does rise out of it, but I like the parallels. And of course, the last line of it is, has this, you know, this angelic land in it. And so I pluck that from the Blake poem and use
yeah.
it for you know, a title about the City of Angels.
Yeah, I love how you were talking before about the Blake poem and how Blake was sort of looking, observing America from a distance over in England. And that brings to mind another thought, sort of a quasi-narrator in your book, Adam Derderian. Adam's older brother, Eric, I guess you could call him the storyteller, who
yeah.
actually lives in New York. And I'm curious, and sort of like Blake, observing America from afar, sort of Adam's older brother, Eric, is kind of looking at Los Angeles from afar. And I'm curious, what do you think the significance is of having a storyteller be someone who's somewhat removed
yeah.
from, in this case, the experience of the riots?
Well, that's true that he is reconstructing, the narrator is reconstructing events that happened over his brother's, over these 4 days of his brother's life. From a distance, mostly from a distance. And also, there's another distance that he is not an American, really. I mean, he is technically, but part of his spirit and history and memory still resides in Lebanon. So there's mm-hmm. that distance that he's writing from as well. And, of course, there's the far historical distance of the Armenian genocide that he's also writing from. So this distance allows him to see things in a, I wouldn't say an omniscient way, but give him a certain objective perspective. He's a documentary filmmaker also, which adds to this. It allows him to come in and move intimately into the reality that his brother faced during those 4 days of perdition through the riots.
Right. You know, this sort of along this line, this question came up for me when reading your book and thinking about you, because I've known you for a little while now. Do you think immigrants sometimes have a more unique view of America, since, you know, as you've said, they are sort of outsiders looking in?
Yeah, there's a character in my novel called the Kurd, whom
yes.
I named the Kurd, and at one point he says, you know, the only people who could really tell the American story are those with one foot in and one foot out. Once you're in with 2 feet, it's already too late. America swallowed you up.
Right.
And I think that the immigrants are the most sensitive to America. They are having to absorb the shocks more than most people who are well padded and been here a while. They're having to check its vitality, its promise. It's all very raw for immigrants. And so, and also, I think you can take measure of the health of the country by listening to immigrants' experience and assimilation here.
Right. You know, I love the story you tell about the story you were writing at the beginning of 92 about a semi-autobiographical novel set in L.A. Narrator is a hip guy living in Mid-Wilshire who wakes one morning to find he's suffering from vertigo, and how that eventually morphed into this angelic land. Can you talk a little about that experience, how that happened?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the Los Angeles Times interview
uh-huh.
with
yep.
David Uhl. I think he
yep.
came out about 6 months ago or so.
Yep.
Yeah, I actually wasn't aware of how the book got started until he asked me the question. I had to go back and do some research into it, and then I was able to reconstruct it. Well, yes, I was living in that area, Mid-Wilshire, and was writing a book that had the central character was a kind of hip 20-something, vaguely, you know, reflecting my own experience, who wakes with vertigo one morning It's about his kind of day in and day outs in the city of L.A. It's full of all the ironies and that a person that age would face in a city like this. And it was pretty sharp, sweet bit of writing, actually, when I went back to read it. But after the riots, in the middle of writing that book, the riots broke out. And when I came back to finish it, I realized that the riots had changed everything. It was no longer the city that he had been living in or I had been living in. And all that had happened had to be taken into account. And that was very intimidating. But I didn't think I could honestly continue writing the book, so I dropped it. And then I came back to it, 17 years later and picked up that character and then married him to a bunch of other stuff, obviously, new stuff.
Sure.
And that was the genesis of the book.
Right. So This Angelic Land is, it's a book about L.A. It's set during the riots, as you've already said. But, it's also a book about America. And I'm curious, how does this L.A. book embody the American experience for you?
Well, part of what I was trying to come to terms with in writing a book about the riots, I thought that 20 years after the fact that, I owed it to the reader and owed it to myself to try to make sense of what this event, what its meaning was, why it happened, but, what it meant for our country. And so that was, I wanted the book that obviously was set in, in the past, but I wanted to be relevant to today. I think that the book, I don't want to get too strong into this because I don't want people to read it from this single frame of mind. But
sure,
the book kind of does pose a hypothesis about what the riots were about and what it means for America today. And one of those is that we have fractured into warring tribes as a country, and these tribes are now trying to use the country to gain advantage, and that contest and struggle between them is inevitable. So the whole promise of E Pluribus Unum, out of the many one, is now disintegrating before our very eyes. And I think that that hypothesis about America is tested in the course of the novel. And I guess it's
right.
Up to the reader to determine, what the whether they agree with the result of the test.
Right. Now, this next question you can frame, within the novel or outside of the novel, your own personal opinion. In the beginning, when I was looking at the L.A. riots, in the beginning it seemed to be really, very clearly race-related. But then as the riots went on, it moved away from that into something darker, less focused. People were burning up their own neighborhoods. And
yes.
I'm curious, what was your take on all of that, from sort of beginning to end?
Well, the book addresses it, I think, explicitly. My take of it probably reflects pretty accurately
right.
what the book, book. I think you're right, and I'm not the first person to observe that the riots started as this kind of, it was against the cops who were, had systematically and systemically abused, the black minority in the city. At first, I think we all thought this was just a kind of, pent-up rage expressing itself. But as time went on, as the hours grew and the next morning began, we realized that it was a lot more than that. And then the whole city got in on the act. And not every citizen in the city, obviously, but a lot of, as I say, the whole Rainbow Coalition was in on it.
Right.
And so then we saw a city turn on itself and rip itself to shreds. I mean, I should remind people that it was the most destructive urban uprising in American history. And yes, we have kind of buried it from memory, but it was a major event, and it echoed and was copycatted all over the country. There were riots all over America in concert with our own. So what, you know, it ended up being and how it died out, I think was an open question, which was partly why I was excited and also a little bit nervous about writing this book. I think it is the first serious novel to approach the subject head on. There have been other books that have used it as a backdrop, and there have been some mystery novel and some poetry. But it's the first novel to really just go right in, dive right into it and try to make sense of it.
Right. Well, I would love it if you could actually read something from the novel if you'd like.
Well, okay. Why don't I read the first chapter, the start of the chapter, because that introduces the narrator and gives a sense of, you know, the tone of the book.
Great.
I was puttering around my Manhattan apartment, still working through jet lag, when the riots in L.A. began. I had just returned from Beirut, where I'd filmed my first feature-length documentary, whose subtitle, The Burden and Promise of Memory, could just as well serve as the title. For what I've decided to embark on here. My parents, my aunt, and my cousin lived in Hollywood and not so far away in mid-Wilshire, where my brother Adam, my good friend Sasha. For 3 days, I sat at the edge of my seat with the TV remote in one hand and the telephone in the other, ringing my brother up nearly every hour, following his eyes on the ground through the helter-skelter path the riots cut. My name is Eric Derderian. My family were refugees from the Lebanese Civil War. And yes, there was a dark irony in the fact that they were now reliving the horrors we had crossed half the world to escape. Yes, I was worried about them, but alongside the worry, I confess, was a vague satisfaction in watching L.A. get precisely what I believed it deserved for the very reasons I had left it. But that satisfaction would quickly dim as the riots spread and my brother's voice grew from astonished to bewildered to alarmed to grim as most of America watched the city collapse upon itself like a building rigged for demolition. Before the smoke had cleared literally, I was boarding a red-eye flight from JFK to LAX. I knew roughly what I would find in Los Angeles, but I was hardly prepared for what I wouldn't.
That's wonderful. You know, you mentioned the Armenian Genocide earlier, and there are, of course, the characters in this novel that are affected by the Lebanese Civil War. I'm curious, how do you feel living through war or genocide or being of a lineage affected by genocide inform one's view of life?
It's a really good question, actually, and one that... you know, people usually, I don't think I've been asked that question. Maybe it's just because no one wants to ask and fear what they'll hear. I think it does a great deal, actually. I think that people who go through these events internally feel in exile probably most of their lives. a diaspora is a spreading of people across, you know, the globe from, you know, a place that they were rooted in Armenian's case, for 2,500 years. And though, you know, my father was born here, my grandpa came, on my dad's side, my grandpa came after the genocide, there is a sense in which a part of you, as deeply rooted as you might be in America, a part of those roots extend beyond here. And you feel at home, you may feel at home in America, it may be your home, but a part of you is still resides elsewhere. So you have to, as a writer, you're constantly affected by this draw towards someplace else. And it gives you a sense of exile internally. I don't know if it's possible to be in a place that is home and exiled, but that's kind of the feeling you have. You're also burdened with memory in a way. And mm-hmm. and you see the power of memory as it works on you and other people in a way that's probably greater than for most other writers. And you and at least for myself, it's very difficult for me to write novels that don't have characters who, you know, are not rooted in these things. I don't feel I have the freedom to just write, you know, about any event that I choose. I feel compelled to, you know, give voice to stories of people who, you know, I've known, or whose stories, who told me their stories, and my two other books, Blood Vine and River Big. They are about my father, who was pushed off land by his brother and was kind of an exile from his own home. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I am kind of, I wouldn't say plagued, and partly it's a blessing, but, you know, I'm locked into history, very much so.
Right, right. You know, I hope I'm not putting you too much on the spot with this next question, and please feel free to address it however you see fit. You know, right around the time your novel was released, This Angelic Land, coinciding with the 20th anniversary of the LA riots, I witnessed firsthand some of the difficulties you went through in trying to get people, and when I say people, I mean like critics, the media, people to pay attention to your book and to help promote it. And, you know, there were some people like David Ulis at the LA Times, who you mentioned earlier, that championed your book, and rightfully so. But with those few exceptions, there seemed to be a lot of resounding no's coming from the media, especially LA-based media, in wanting to sort of help you promote this book. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, and how much of it do you think had to do with LA not wanting to examine its own demons?
It's, you know, it's a hard question without sounding paranoid or, you know,
right.
bitter.
Right.
You know, that's but it's, I think it is a fair question, because it was the first novel of its kind. There was a lot of coverage of the 20th anniversary of the riots in LA. I mean, the LA Times was just cascading with stories, you know, it covered every angle from it. But people were not willing to take the book up. And,
right.
And not just promote, use the word promote, but just acknowledge it and do what they would do with it, you know. And that was hard. It was really hard to know why. And it took me, you know, it's been 1 month out, 1 year out now. And so I've had some time to sit back and think about it. I think that, you know, people in LA are reluctant to visit their history, the darker sides of their history. There's no doubt about it. Or if they do visit it, they want to be able to, at the end, conclude that, you know, we are the world, we all get along again, or things have changed and we're happy about that, or communities are getting better and this and that. Well, I'm not sure that that is the conclusion of this book. And the book is very hard-hitting. I mean, some people may even say that aspects of it are racist. Mm-hmm. So that may be part of it as well. It goes after the throats of nearly every ethnic group in the city. It doesn't mince words. The characters are very outspoken. And so it doesn't toe the party line in terms of what the media usually likes to hear from people who cover these events. There is a kind of orthodoxy when you're talking about riots. There's a certain pattern that people follow in discussing these, but novelists don't follow patterns. They follow the tale and the sentiment of their characters. And so I think ultimately the story was uncontrollable. So if they opened it up and they opened up this can of worms, they were going to have to follow the novel down the road that the novel was taking. And they simply just did not know how to handle that. So they would rather talk to pundits whose point of views they more or less know, who talk more or less the right way, and have an intelligent discussion about it. But not with the novelists, because novelists are, you know, they may say things that you don't want to hear.
Right.
And I think that largely accounts for the people turning their eyes and backs away from this book.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think another L.A. riots could happen again? And if so, what could be some of the driving factors next time around, and what shape might it take?
I have a couple feelings about that. On the one hand, I think that, you know, there's no doubt that enough frustration builds up in any city, and systematic frustrations, and people will explode one by one, and then if enough of them, you know, face a single trauma together, then they can rise up and, revolt or rebel. But on the other hand, I think that the surveillance mechanism in America has gotten so powerful that it's harder and harder for people to get away with that kind of thing. And also they don't feel that they can get away with that kind of thing, which is perhaps more important, is the anticipation of being stopped in your track and hauled off to a Guantanamo.
Right.
You know, that silences people and keeps them in place. And I think that's become very, very strong since 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Occupy Wall Street was shut down fairly efficiently. You know, you have Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks and Guantanamo, but there's a whole different feeling than there was in 1992.
Right.
And I think people are much less likely to revolt or rebel or have an uprising than they did 20 years ago.
Yeah. How has your novel changed your feelings about Los Angeles, either during its creation or, you know, now after it's been released?
Well, that's, you know, most people, I think, have the idea that, you know, a novelist kind of writes, you know, from a disembodied state. What you're writing about doesn't really affect you, except as you're writing it, of course, you have to get into it and you have to feel the characters and feel the city and the pulse of it. And I think that that's been true of my other work. But I have to confess that after writing this book, I did have a different feeling about Los Angeles. And that actually surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess digging into the underbelly of a city as I did sets you up for a certain kind of disappointment, more than usual. But actually, I was surprised that it was more than the usual disappointment. It was a kind of really, really feeling of having come to terms with the city and not feeling so great about it.
Yeah. You know, L.A. is palm trees, L.A. is beauty, promise of fame and fortune. So many things about L.A., you know, sort of allude to the promise of something better, a brighter tomorrow, and so little rooted in the present moment. And, you know, so little rooted in the past, so people constantly moving forward with their eye on the prize. I'm curious, given all that, what have you found here in L.A., some things that you've been able to hold on to? Because I know you're moving soon. You're moving to Fresno with your family. So in your time here in Los Angeles, what have been the things you could been able to hold on to and really cherish?
Well, obviously, just friends. You know, I have a few of them, not many. I've lived here a long time. You know, obviously, little things like the neighborhood I live in, the, you know, old Jewish lady next door who, you know, bakes us a cake once every couple months. Sweet things like that. You know, my neighborhood, my place. Outside of that, very, very little, really. I have, you know, I'm practicing yogi, and that obviously has been very important to me. But I could, you know, more or less take that anywhere. There's little, you know, what I've held on to are the small things that probably most people hold on to. It really isn't the city and all the things that people come here thinking they will find. It's the little things that people find anywhere in the world, which is intimate relationships, good friendships, et cetera. But I think that that is very hard to find in L.A., and this is why people are terribly frustrated here, usually not articulating it, because people come here for a reason, and that is to move away from where they were. And so that ambition alongside, you know, high intelligence, high creativity, and all those things that make the city vibrant make it very difficult to form intimate friendships and very quiet intimate friendships where people just enjoy getting together and enjoy each other's company without worrying whether, you know, you can help them or they can help you get to the next place in terms of their careers and dreams.
Yeah. We're getting close to the end of our time, Aris. Where can people find you online? Where can they get your book?
Well, my book is, you know, since there's hardly any bookstores left, you know, I would recommend people just go to Amazon to purchase it. The bookstore, most of the bookstores in town have copies of it. You can go to BookSoup or Skylight or any of the independents. But I would just recommend people go to Amazon, and if you go to Amazon, buy it from one of the dealers at Amazon and not Amazon itself, because, you know, those are small guys trying to make an extra buck, and it's nice to support them as well.
Yeah.
So in terms of, I don't have an online presence, really. You can Facebook me, and usually I accept Facebook friends because it's part of building, you know, a readership and letting people know where you are. I don't have a website, believe it or not. I'm probably the last person on earth not to have a website. But, you know, that's the way to do it. Go to Amazon and Facebook me, and you know, we'll communicate, and hope you'll enjoy the book.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Aris.
Thank you for having me, Rich. You have a great program, and I wish you the well with it. And I look forward to seeing you at yoga at some point.
Oh, yeah. We will see each other in passing or in the same class, I'm sure. With me today has been author Aris Janigian, author of Bloodvine, River Big, and in his most current novel, This Angelic Land. I want to send a big thank you out to our show sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. The show's theme music is by We Voice Sing. Speaking of which, you can find me online, Rich Ferguson, at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, my poetry collection, Eighth and Agony. You can also find on Amazon. And next week, my guest will be L.A. poet Steve Abey. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poet Escape.